You know that feeling when you're really excited about something and then you sit down and you're like, all right, I'm going to show everybody this thing that I'm really excited about. And then all of the anxiety ever hits you and you're like, can't do the thing, gonna freak out. That's where I'm at right now. Hi, my name is Amy, and some of you may know me as Amy Rose. I'm a writer, an artist, and a general spooky weirdo. And this is my new project, Grim Fixation. It is a podcast where I talk about whatever weird, spooky related thing is catching my attention right now. So, I have this fascination with death gods and mythology. And the way that our brains work and the way that we rationalize the world around us. And I love ghost stories. I love true crime. I love all kinds of things. Just fair warning, I'm probably not going to talk about too much true crime on here. May talk about some hauntings. Definitely want to talk about some methods for hunting ghosts because it's fascinating to me. For a little further context, I am an atheist. I am an American, clearly, by my accent, if you couldn't tell. And I'm somewhat of a skeptic, but I think the more appropriate term would be I'm more agnostic when it comes to ghosts, meaning that I don't really know. Do I completely agree with all of the logical side presented by skeptics? Oh, yeah, definitely. Have I seen and heard experiences from other people and from people that I know and trust that I can't explain? Yeah, definitely. So I have no idea. But anyway. So getting back to the death gods, since that is where this episode is going to be classified under. Because I'm an atheist, I never really grew up with any kind of formal religion. Technically, I'm culturally Christian, as most Americans are, even if they are of other religions. You're around here often enough, you get to deal with, well, okay, that's putting it in a very negative light, and I don't mean to be doing that. But I was raised with, Easter and Christmas and other Christian holidays. Whether I ever did the church thing or not, it was pretty rare. So I have a very bizarre relationship, I think, with religion and beliefs and things beyond what you can see and touch in front of you. I'm fascinated by it, and I recognize that for other people, it is a very comforting thing, it's a hope-filled thing, it's a beneficial thing for individuals. And I realize and recognize that it creates community, and community is a healthy thing. We are social creatures. We thrive with community, and community interaction. I also recognize that some organized religions and other things like that, some organized groups of people, even outside of religions, can do some very bad things together when you get somebody with nefarious motives. Tweaking things in their advantage or to their advantage. But yeah, the concept of the way that we rationalize the world around us and always have is fascinating to me. And again, getting back to my original attempt at a tangent, that especially seems to focus for me on death gods and our mourning rituals. Not mourning like you wash your face, brush your teeth, eat eggs, and drink coffee, but more when someone that you know or someone that you don't know passes, how we as humans deal with that. What kind of stories comfort us? What kind of creatures and entities have we created that we've either created or believe exist to help us process these things, this natural cycle of life. And so it's fascinating to me. And I've been taking the last several years to write the beginning of a murder mystery book series. It's queer fiction, and I love it a lot. It kind of starts on that basis of a Mulder and Scully style dynamic of a skeptic character who doesn't really believe in anything, has no experience with, the paranormal, like ghosts or magic in this case of my specific created world. He has none of that and gets thrown together into this investigation with somebody who has a ton of experience with it, uses magic like he breathes. And I love that dynamic. It is one of my favorite dynamics ever. So it's something that I've been working on for a really long time. And one of the things that I've been working with it, or working on with it, is using different death gods and deities from mythology over the course of human history as inspirations for certain characters. Which that'll be another episode in the future once I get through my revisions and actually get this book anywhere near sharing with people. But I've been interested in those specific creatures, and in doing research for this book and learning how to write and craft characters and craft a believable murder mystery and a enriched and diverse world and cast, I've sought out information, and there are certain things that are really easy to find. You can find 100 million different ways to write a novel, different plot arcs, different how-to guides. Everybody and their cousin has a book about it. There's a lot out there, and it's sort of a pick and choose what works for you style recipe for making a book. So there's that. And then, especially in the last several years with Black Lives Matter and Me Too and all of these movements and communities reaching out and being like, hey, media and white people, you need to recognize how you present people who are different, who are minorities, who don't get treated the same as you in everyday public lives and private lives and things like that. You need to be more cognizant of it when you put together books. And it's easy to reach out there and find resources and find places where you can hear people and listen to people and interact with people who have these, experiences that someone like me does not necessarily have, and be able to take it and look at your cast and be like, wow, you're right. Every person that I've written is white, heterosexual, not neurodivergent, all of that, and leans Christian, and it's like, okay, that's not a true reflection of the world, not the world that I live in, at least. And it's definitely, for me as a writer, caused me to take that step back and look at my cast and go, okay, does this character need to be white and straight and able-bodied and non-neurodivergent? No. What if this is where they come from? And not like immigration or anything like that. Not trying to other people, but what if I approach the character from this angle? What if they have this cultural background, this view of the world. How can that change them and their interactions with my main character? How can that make my main characters change, what they see by the end of the book, by book two, by book five? So it's been really fun. So those are things that I've been researching. And then I get back to, like I said, I want to base some of my characters on mythology and specifically death gods. And I've found it's very easy to walk into, excuse me, it's very easy to walk into any library or bookstore and find several books on mythology. Oh, it's mythology and religions from around the world. Every one of them, at least here in the States, focuses on Celtic, Norse, Greek, Roman, and Egyptian. That's it. That's the Western world. That's ignoring our indigenous people. That's ignoring so many other cultures, so many other regions. And for the most part, none of those books really touch on death gods. They'll have creation myths, they'll have all these other things, but where is the Grim Reaper in all of this? Where is our rationalization of mortality and the limit of our life and our time here? So I've been over the years collecting little stories in my bookmarks and occasionally ranting to my best friend about it or my husband, and they go, "Yes, that's awesome, Amy. Thank you. Thank you. Yep." And I've been saving them to my Tumblr under a tag called Death Gods Are the World to Me because it's fascinating. And the people who follow me on Tumblr, because yes, I am one of those Tumblr people, are just like, yeah, okay, Amy, thank you. And some people are totally geeked out over it too, and it's great. But I have yet to find, and I'm sure once I put this out there, other than like Morbid Anatomy and The Order of the Good Death and people in the death industry who create these blogs and Twitters and YouTube communities and things like that who do this. But specifically, I have not been able to find a book where you can pick it up and go, oh, let's look at Japan and what kind of death-related myths and creatures are from there? Or anything like that. So that's sort of where this podcast comes in, is I have in the last several years, in addition to writing my novel, been toying with the idea of creating a death god book of my own. But at the same time, I don't really want to write another book, so I'm just going to talk in a microphone every week about the death gods that are entertaining me right now. And I was like, okay, that's a great idea. That could be really fun. Where the hell do I start, though? And it was a conversation with my best friend Melody when I realized I have to start at the beginning. And the beginning for most people, or at least most Americans, not necessarily the big, not necessarily the beginning beginning, like the Big Bang, but the most basic. When you think of death as an American in a personified form, you probably think of the Grim Reaper. Skeleton guy wears a black robe with a hood, carries a big swoopy scythe. That guy. And so I was like, all right, perfect. That'll be a great starting episode. I can do that real quick and then move on to, the Dullahan and Meng Po and Thoth and move on to what the hell are spirit boxes and where can I get one? And why does sleep paralysis affect people in the same way? What are the limits of the human imagination? All of these things that fascinate me. That's what I want to move on to. So I was like, perfect, Grim Reaper, that'll be an easy one to do research on. Yeah. It was fun. Well, you'll see. So, in order to talk about the Grim Reaper, let's talk about where death gods got their start. At least as far as recorded history. So we're going back to about 6,000 BCE. And yeah, anyway. So about 8,000 years we're going to go back. Specifically to Lower Egypt. And we're going to talk about Thoth. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. I really hope so. Everything that I saw put it as that. Anyway. So Thoth was the Egyptian god of, and I quote, writing, magic, wisdom, the moon, equilibrium, and balance. He was also closely associated with the principle of Maat. I did not look up the pronunciation of that. I will spell it for you. M-A apostrophe A-T. I apologize for not pronouncing that however it is supposed to be pronounced. So this principle is a principle of divine balance, and there is a goddess by the same name who he is also closely associated with. In some of the mythology, he is married to her, in some he is married to someone else whose name I did not write down because I want to do a more thorough episode on him specifically later. So this is just a quick bit. Thoth presided over judgment of the dead with Osiris in what they called the Hall of Truth. Basically, when you died, your soul went to this Hall of Truth, and they put your soul on a scale with, I believe it was a feather on the other side. I'm not positive. Again, I want to go deeper into his stuff later. And whether or not the scale dipped or went up, it depended or decided which way you went. And basically, Thoth was the one who would be called in when the person whose soul was going there was really nervous about that exam. They weren't sure if they were going to go to the good place or the bad place. Yes, I'm borrowing language from The Good Place. That TV show is awesome. I need to finish it. But basically, it's like, okay, I wasn't the best person, but was I really that bad? Hey, Thoth, come help me. You know, I mean, can you be my hype man here? Can you help me get through this? He was that guy. It says worship of Thoth began in Lower Egypt, most likely in the pre-dynastic period from 6000 to 3150 BCE, and continued through the Ptolemaic period, I think that's how you pronounce it, the last dynastic era of Egyptian history, marking Thoth's veneration as among the longest of the Egyptian gods or any deity from any civilization. So all of that was from a website called ancient.eu/Thoth, and his name is spelled Thoth. All right, and then from Wikipedia, yes, I am citing Wikipedia. Do not care. quote, he was the god of wisdom, writing, hieroglyphics, science, magic, art, and judgment, and the dead. And it was said because about 6,000 years ago is when we started as humans. So about 6,000 years ago was when we started writing. And I have it somewhere in my notes. Where is it? I have the name of the language. Sumerian, that's what it was. So Sumerian was one of the first written languages after hieroglyphics, but it was one of the ones that could be translated. Again, that's going to be a whole other episode because I can definitely go down that rabbit hole, I am sure. It's fascinating to me. But the Egyptians saw Thoth as the one who created the hieroglyphics, who created this ability to write and share thoughts and stories and news and all of that through hieroglyphics. And then came the Greeks. And to be honest, I don't remember that part of my history lessons. Basically, from what I could see on my brief research, and by brief, I mean I spent the last week and a half focusing specifically on this episode. And it came to me that, or I found that there was a Greek part of Egypt. They became buddies. I don't know if it was amicable, if it was war. I don't know. Again, I will do an episode on Thoth specifically and get better answers to this in the future. But the Greeks came in and they were like, dude, Thoth is awesome. He sounds like a great god. And you know what? He sounds so cool. He sounds exactly like our dude, Hermes. Like he's a great god. He is, they're basically the same. They're exactly the same. Yeah, literally they started, and I don't remember if this is, I couldn't tell if this is the Egyptians calling Thoth this, or if this is the Greeks calling Thoth this, or if this is the Egyptian Greek area calling Thoth this. But one of Thoth's titles was thrice great, three times great, making him, or making Hermes, hold on. Basically, one of his titles was thrice great, making him, or making Hermes, Hermes Trismegistus. Magistus? Trismegistus. That sounds like a magic spell. Okay. And that's not me trying to insult the language or anything. I am just saying it sounds very Wingardium Leviosa. I apologize. Let's see. So the original Egyptian god Thoth, he was a lunar deity. He was associated with the moon, and he's very old. Again, that was like 6000 BC. He's usually portrayed as a baboon or an ibis, which is a type of bird with a really long, pointy, curvy nose, sort of like a scythe, foreshadowing. Or a man with an ibis head. So, a dude with a big, long, pointy beak. He is one of the oldest Egyptian gods, and evidence for his worship goes back to at least the early kingdom period, 2686 to 2160 BC, if not before. So, slightly different things. This is from the god Hermes, The Roman Obsession with the Egyptian God Thoth. It was an article that I found online. I'm snapping for no reason because it helps me focus. Says the Greeks came to Egypt after the conquests of Alexander the Great, late 4th century BC onwards. They absorbed many important Egyptian deities into their pantheon, and the god Thoth was one of them. The Greeks assumed that Thoth and the god Hermes must be the same person. As with many other gods and heroes in the Greek pantheon, Hermes was transformed because of his association, I can speak my native language, I promise, with the Egyptian deity. Like Thoth, the god Hermes was often a guide, a messenger, and an espouser of wit and learning. The merger of Thoth and Hermes's respective stories led the Hellenic Greeks to wonder, had this god once roamed the earth dishing out knowledge to humans. The city of Kamunu in Egypt was later renamed Hermopolis, the city of Hermes. Greek Egypt eventually fell to the Romans. The Romans loved their new Hermes Thoth mashup, and since the god Hermes and the god Mercury were already interchangeable to the Romans, because they were like, great, sweet, new gods, they were quite happy to incorporate multiple versions of the same god into their religious traditions. What they found in Egypt was a god who was soon credited as a sort of wandering wise man who gave writing, theology, and other learned disciplines to the many peoples of the world. So basically, Thoth, or Hermes, or Mercury, all of them, one being, would walk around just teaching humans things. Just here's religion, here is writing, here is how to be a good person, here is how to function, here's fire. Maybe, I don't know about the fire part, but he was a teacher and all of that. Under the Roman Empire, few people could read ancient hieroglyphs anymore, and Latin writers spread the idea that they contained a secret or magical knowledge, an idea that persists to this day. Raise your hand if you've ever seen a movie where Egyptians and hieroglyphics can have magic curses or spells. Raise your hand if you've ever seen a movie or TV show where Latin is used with magic. All of your hands should be up. Just saying. So this ancient knowledge, they believed, had been passed down along a long line of philosophers for thousands of years, starting with the god Thoth. So basically, they saw all of the hieroglyphics, which is a language created of, if you're not familiar, which, or just don't remember, it's a language created of symbols, and the symbols look like animals and shapes and things like that. And they stand for either a sound, like the sound of the word bird, or the actual bird itself. I don't remember what that's called. It's from a video on languages that I watched a couple months ago and partially absorbed into my brain. So there you go. But the Roman Empire decided, hey, we don't know how to read that. Must be magic. Definitely magic. And everybody's like, no, it's a language. It means that they're, no, it's magic. Your god gave you magic powers. Under the Romans, it wouldn't take long before texts started appearing claiming to contain this primordial philosophy written by Hermes himself. The, quote, writings of Hermes, known as the Hermetica, attracted a cult following and were influenced by Egyptian religion, Jewish and early Christian ideas, and Greek philosophy. So basically, like I said, they were sitting there going, wow, all of these, like, etchings on this wall, all of these carvings, they're so cool. They definitely contain the secrets of the universe. Somebody else is like, hey, that's just saying, here lies this person. They were awesome. This is how they went through their life. This is who they caught. No. It's definitely the meaning of life. Definitely that's how to be invisible and turn yourself into a bear or make Susie over there fall in love with me. Like, it's definitely that. It's not a life story. It can't be. It's magic. Shut up. Leave me alone. I mean, obviously, this is definitely what happened. So that's basically where Thoth became Hermes Mercury, Hermetica, because of friendships and war and conquering and time stretching forward. And it paints a particular tendency that we as humans have, which is to go through and capture cultures that we find interesting. capture in both a take a picture of and the darker version, and just be like, I like this. This is mine. This is now mine. I will now use it for my own purposes. Anyway. So let's focus a little bit more on Hermes himself. So this is specifically notes from the Wikipedia article on Hermes. I definitely want to do a big long episode on him because he sounds awesome and interesting. Okay. So it says here, Hermes is a deity from Mount Olympus in ancient Greek mythology and religion. He was considered the herald or messenger of the gods. Basically, the gods would be like, hey, Hermes, come here. Yeah, this is Zeus here. So you need to go tell all of those people I slept with that I'm going to ignore their kids. Okay, thanks, bye. Because Zeus is awesome. So that was his job. He could pass between the world of the gods on Mount Olympus down to the world with the humans and be like, hey, Zeus is a douchebag. He just doesn't care. Hermes was also considered the protector of the human heralds. So messengers among the humans, he would protect them. He also protected travelers, thieves, merchants, and orators. Public speakers, basically. He was able to move quickly and freely between the worlds of the mortal and the divine, and was aided in that by wearing winged sandals, which Mercury also wears. We're not really going to touch on Mercury in this, but I just wanted to acknowledge that he also wears those. All right. In some of the oldest accounts, Hermes was seen as a chthonic deity, someone heavily associated with the earth and or the underworld. The association between Hermes and the underworld is related to his function as a god of boundaries, the boundary between life and death. He's also considered what they call a psychopomp, and that is a deity who helps guide souls from this world that you and I all know to the afterlife. His image was commonly put on gravestones in classical Greece and things like that. As a chthonic deity, the worship of Hermes also included an aspect of relating to fertility, with the phallus being among one of his major symbols. That has nothing to do with death, really, but it's hilarious. So one of his original symbols was dicks. You could just, like, put his face on a gravestone and then slap his face on a desk and it's like drawing a dick or something. I don't know. It's hilarious to me. Like I said, I wanted to do a nice long episode on him. So Homer wrote about Hermes in the Iliad. And he described him as the bringer of good luck, guide and guardian, and excellent in all tricks. Because he was a trickster as well. The earliest known theological or spiritual documents concerning Hermes was found in 7th century BC Homeric hymns. It's Homeric hymn 4 to Hermes describes the god's birth and his theft of Apollo's sacred cattle. In this hymn, Hermes is invoked as a god of many shifts, quote-unquote, associated with cunning and thievery. He was also a bringer of dreams and a night guardian. He was also said to have invented the lyre, the little, like, harpy doodle thing, racing, and the sport of wrestling. So, this dude, he protects people who send messages. So, protects your prime delivery drivers, UPS drivers, things like that. Protects travelers, so if you're traveling somewhere or you're just a general wanderer in life, move a lot like me, he's on your side. If you're a thief, great, he's there for you apparently. Merchants, you sell things, he's there. You do a lot of public speaking. He's in the corner going, "Woo, break a leg." Except don't, but kind of do. And then he's also gonna play tricks on you, like steal your cattle for no reason, bring you good dreams, protect you in the night. And then he's gonna challenge you to a race or something. He's an all-around fascinating god. But also, like many of the Greek gods, he's presented as someone who is sort of like a regular human. A lot of the old gods, and I'm specifically talking about like Greeks and Norse and like Celtic and things like that, they have their own families, they have their own lives in this like god world, Mount Olympus sort of thing. And then they also can interact, at least briefly, or through messengers like Hermes, with humans. But they are seen as creatures like you and me, just gods. Djinn are also like this. I want to go into that. If you want to know more about them specifically now and not wait for me to eventually get around to Djinn, there is an awesome podcast on it, which I will look up the name of because I cannot remember it. The Hidden Djinn. Look up The Hidden Djinn. DJINN. It's fantastic. She talks about a lot of djinn stories, specific djinn around the world, and more specifically in the countries where they're native. So yeah, it's fascinating. But again, djinn are very old, similarly old to gods like Thoth and Hermes and all of that. And they are seen as beings who have families and homes and their own drama, their own baby mama drama like Zeus, and function in a very similar way to humans, just with a longer life and slightly more magical powers. But this episode isn't really about them. Remember, it's about the Grim Reaper. Now, like I said, if you think of death with a capital D and a little person, you think of black robe and a hood. Skeleton dude, usually silent and pointing at things. Carries a big ol' scythe. You don't think about death unless you're looking at like a New Yorker comic or something like that, having to mow a lawn somewhere or, you know, get married, raise little deathling kids. It's a very different approach to a deity. It's a very different approach to the whole concept of a psychopomp. This concept of when you die, you meet this being who is there to take you from one life to whatever happens beyond that. And this is where we get to my foolhardy idea that, hey, the Grim Reaper will be an easy first episode. That's going to be an easy bit of research because surely there is some mythos out there specifically that said, yeah, during this time in this culture, the Grim Reaper was created. It gave him a little sharp little pointy knife and a little hood and sent his skeleton ass out into the world. Not really, no. So about halfway through the week, well, not even halfway through the week, earlier this week, this last week, it's the day after Valentine's Day 2021 right now. So, beginning of last week, I quickly realized that it's not very easy to find. It's not very easy to find like actual facts about where the Grim Reaper story came from. Now, I mean, if you look up where did the Grim Reaper come from, you will find 10 million blogs and videos some from The New Yorker talking about their comics, which they actually do a pretty good job with the Grim Reaper comics. It's hilarious. They kind of very quickly go, oh yeah, the Grim Reaper was created during the Middle Ages, Black Plague. Done. And I'm like, huh. Okay, cool. Where though? Like, was it in a book? Did it come about from like a specific comedian thing? Was it like a meme that just went too far? Like I said, who gave him his little robe and scythe? I want to know. And that was quite a bit harder to figure out. Let's talk about specifically the name to start with. So, the first time that the term Grim Reaper appeared, it was in a book by, well, originally it was in German, and it was by Dr. Frederick August Gottgetr. Oh man, my German is so bad. I mean, it's not bad, it's just been a real long time since I took German. Dr. Tholuck, we'll say that. And so it was a book originally published in 1841, and in 1847, I can speak. Reverend Robert Menzies translated this German book into a book called The Circle of Human Life. And it's a book of Christian meditations and devotions, according to an auction site that I found selling a translated edition from 1850. So the relevant passage, as translated in the Circle of Life that I found from this auction website, says, and I quote, "All know full well that life cannot last above 70 or at the most 80 years. If we reach that term without meeting the Grim Reaper with his scythe, there or thereabout, meet him we surely shall." So basically, this German guy, Dr. Tholuck, and then Reverend Robert Menzies. But Dr. Tholuck was like, yeah, we're only gonna live to like 70, maybe 80. And then we're gonna die. And we're gonna meet the Grim Reaper. And that's basically the first time that we ever called him that in print. We being humans collectively. And again, that's in 1847. Little teaser, the plague didn't start until, or the plague happened about 500 years before that. The Black Death originally landed in Europe in about 1346, and the last time it had a major breakout in Europe, specifically in England, was in 1665 to 1666. It definitely hit other parts of the world after that, and unfortunately continues to hit other parts of the world even now, at least in small amounts, though less with COVID social distancing, hopefully, because hopefully everybody who needs to stay at home is staying at home away from people instead of going shopping. I know you're not, but anyway. One can hope. One who is a retail worker having to deal with people complain about things while the world is ending. Anyway, so 1847 is quite a bit after that 1666. And with everybody saying the Grim Reaper is definitely from the Middle Ages and specifically the plague times, I'm like, I'm curious. So again, let's talk about the name Grim Reaper. So grim, it's an adjective, means fierce in disposition or action, stern or forbidding, somber, gloomy, ghastly, repellent or sinister, unflinching and unyielding. These are all really heavy, heavy definitions. And I am going to. Okay. I'm gonna record one more little definition in here, and then I'm gonna have to stop this part of the recording and start another part of the recording so I don't run out of space, it is telling me. So the second part of his name, reap. Reap is a verb. It means to cut, specifically with a sickle, which is the little swoopy circly knife, a scythe, the big pointy curvy knife, or a reaping machine. It's to clear a crop or harvest, also can mean obtain or win. And Grim Reaper altogether, often capitalized with a capital G and a capital R, like a proper name. Death, especially when personified as a man or a skeleton with a scythe. So, in a very literal sense, the Grim Reaper's name boils down to an entity who is gloomy and unyielding in their quest to harvest their crop, which, since the Grim Reaper is Death with a capital D, or at least someone who works on behalf of him, depending on which version of the Grim Reaper you look at, that means our buddy Grim has to harvest a lot of souls. All of the souls. Okay, cool. It is processing part one of my recording, which got a little long, and that's fine. So, like I said, the Grim Reaper's name boils down to someone who is gloomy and unyielding in their quest to harvest human souls. That's dark. That's not, I'm gonna call up my buddy Thoth and he's gonna do me a solid by helping me pass this soul exam so I don't go to the bad place. It's not, Hermes is there in my corner cheering me on while I give a public speech, or playing a trick on me when I'm about to go on a race or wrestle or something. Like, that's a big difference. So let's take a look at the plague. Not the current plague that we're in, and I use plague in air quotes there. I'm specifically talking about the bubonic plague. First the Black Death, and then the Great Death, depending on who you talk to and in what specific iteration of it. But yeah, anyway, let's talk about that. So like I said, in about 1346, 1347, depending on which source you look at, the Black Death arrived in Europe. Fleas on rats infested the people and gave them all the bubonic plague. Boils were everywhere. So between 1346 and 1353, somewhere between 75 to 200 million people in Eurasia and North Africa, meaning Europe, Asia, and North Africa, died from the bubonic plague. It potentially reduced the global population from about 475 million to only 350 million, or about 25% of Earth's total population at the time. That's a lot. That's a whole lot. Fun fact, in 1377, in the midst of this plague, or shortly after, or in a recurrence, I don't remember because I didn't have the energy to write down every occurrence of the plague. It just kept coming back, like bad things that come back. I had a joke there and then I forgot it halfway through saying it. It's fine. So in 1377, Italy passed a law establishing a Trentino, or a 30-day isolation period. This was eventually extended to a 40-day isolation period, which changed the name from Trentino to Quarantino, or quarantine. I'm sure that is a word you're tired of hearing about, and I apologize. Like I said, I currently am a quote-unquote essential worker, which means that I've been working through this whole thing and I haven't really had to deal with quarantine. Just a lot of people who need entertainment and supplies during said quarantine. So I feel ya, but not really. Hopefully this entertains you. All right, so that was the first plague. That was the Black Death. Very first time. The very. No, I hit my notebook. So, the last major outbreak of the plague in England specifically was the Great Plague that happened from 1665 to 1666. And it killed about 200,000 people, or a quarter of London's population at the time. 200,000 in a year. That's a quarter of the population. That's a lot. I didn't bother to do the math because it's depressing and we're going through shit right now here in the US, but do that in your own time. So this plague, the Great Plague, specifically the 1665 to 1666, that's the one that brought us plague doctors, the one where, they wear the funny hat, the bird face with the long nose, where you've got different spices and things like that in the tip of the bird beak nose to try to keep the bad air away, because that's what they thought caused it, was these big plumes of bad air. It wasn't, it was fleas, but that's okay. Again, this wasn't really a time of great science. They didn't know shit yet. That's part of science, is learning shit. Anyway, so we had plague doctors. It also brought about plague pits. Unfortunately, I think it was few hundred years after, I want to say, because I didn't write this down, I just read it in an article. I think it was about 300 years later. Somebody discovered in one of the parishes affected by the plague a mass grave of about 1,114 bodies, I think. From what I could tell in that article, it wasn't totally common. It was supposed to always be a temporary thing. No human history really has wanted to do mass graves, it doesn't sound like, from my research so far over the years. But unfortunately, sometimes people be dying super fast. In fact, there was 1 week in 1665 from September 19th to September 26th of 1665. It was the worst week of the Great Plague, where 7,166 people died in that 1 week in London. Which, I mean, I'm not from there, I've never been there, but I'm pretty sure it's a pretty concentrated area, even at the time. So that's wild. That is a wild, wild amount of people. And you have to think, not everybody works as a mortician or has space for that or anything. Like, containing and disposing of bodies sometimes gets backed up. And I know that that's something that the death industry here in the US and probably other parts of the world, but we in particular are fucking up this COVID response pretty badly, are dealing with some backlog, which is super unfortunate, of being able to take care of our dead. So that was a particular problem during this plague, and hence plague pits or mass graves. As such, because people were dying so quickly, some parishes, and no one can really tell, at least from my research that I was doing, whether this was a big organized, like, service that somebody who was, taking advantage of the situation put together, or if it was something that each parish or each little town, little part of London put together themselves, organized themselves. But basically, at night, somebody would drive around with a cart and either ring a bell or call out bring out your dead. Literally, if you've seen Monty Python, it's actually not far off. And people who were affected would bring out their dead for these carts. That's gonna be relevant soon to my death god thing, but not quite at the moment. We're still gonna focus on facts and history and sadness. So, let's see. So, around this time of the Great Plague, it says, and this was from a book that I didn't bother writing. Oh, wait, no. This is from a book called Burial, Epidemic Disease in London, specifically from a section called Burial of the Plague Dead in Early Modern London by Vanessa Harding. It was published in 1993, and I found all of this from an archive of history.ac.uk. So it says, around this time, artists increasingly depicted death in the form of cold, dead, naked, unrecognizable bodies becoming food for worms. Quote, "The death most to be feared is the mass death because of its extravagant multiplication of disfigured bodies. This is the pile of dead bodies on stage at the end of the revenge drama." And it looks like this was talking about Othello, because it was talking about Iago at the start of this paragraph. But this is the pile of dead bodies in the plague pit. Yeah, so it also says here from the same part of the same book, says from July of 1665 onwards, an early reference to slings to carry the dead corpses, and the absence of any later references to carts suggests that the burying was always done on foot in these parishes or these specific parts, being St. Bride's and St. Dunstan's. Dunstan's? I don't know. It was difficult to discover whether a centralized system of dead carts ever existed or whether it was always carried about. out by parishes perhaps acting together in groups. The dead carts in the city were not confined to particular parishes, but one cart went through several parishes according as the number of dead presented, so it's kind of a supply and demand thing there. And it was restricted to nighttime collection and nighttime burial to try to keep people from having to see it. It was criticized, it was later criticized that this might have been used to facilitate the concealment of plague deaths. But by the 17th century, this requirement was the norm. This was not always observed, because sometimes the nights were too short to bury all of the dead, and you would basically either see them during the day, see funerals happen during the day. This author that she is citing was talking about how it was strange to see in broad daylight two or three burials upon the bank side. And by September, it sounded like they had just given up on trying to do the whole cover of night thing and just went, well, a lot of people are dying and we gotta take care of them somehow by burying them in the middle of the day. Alright, and then this specific bit talks about the cultural impact that this particular plague had on London and the rest of England. It's from a book called Representing the Plague in Early Modern England by Rebecca Totaro. The passage says, in early modern England, death was a common visitor, coming in many shapes, but however horrifying and dehumanizing they were, leprosy, smallpox and syphilis, famine, war and murder, in plague time became lesser manifestations of death. Each one was considered a, quote, plague, meaning originally in Greek and in Latin, a blow, stroke, or wound, especially associated with punishment. But only what we now know as the bubonic plague was called the Great Mortality and the Plague. No other disease altered physical, social, religious, medical, and civil behavior and beliefs at once, generation after generation, and sometimes decades after decade, year after year. No other single phenomenon had a more decisive effect than the plague in shaping the early modern crisis of death and the way that humans thought of themselves in relationship to it. So basically, all of these people dying between, like I said, 1346 when it first appeared and 1666 when England had its last big outbreak of it. All these people dying is what made everybody go, yeah, if there is a death god, he's a fucking skeleton and he's a dick, basically. He was no longer people's friends. So, because I'm sure some of you are curious at the moment, skip over the next 10-15 seconds if you don't want to hear a COVID update. But COVID-19 update from worldometer.com. As of February 14th, 2021, worldwide coronavirus cases, this is total, cumulative, 109,622,545. Total deaths worldwide, cumulative, 2,417,066. And recovered cases, 84,060,179. So we're still not even remotely approaching the bubonic plague levels, and thankfully we're not approaching bubonic plague levels. It's still incredibly serious. Wear a fucking mask, stay home, but we're not there, thankfully. So we were talking earlier in here about how artists started changing the way that we drew and presented death, with a capital D. What did that look like? Well, Danse Macabre, Totentanz, Death and the Maiden. You might have heard some of these words before. So from the book by Morbid Anatomy creator and author Joanna Epstein, this is from a book, Death, A Graveside Companion, with a foreword by Will Self and art from the Richard Harris Collection. This is an awesome book, by the way. My best friend Melody sent it to me for Christmas, and I love it, and it's awesome, and it's filled with horrifying and hilarious art depicting the different ways that we've shown both the physicality of death, like the way that our bodies decompose, but also the way that we personify death, and it's very entertaining to me. But this chunk of stuff about Danse Macabre I found from this book. So, from section 4, the personification, that's a word, the personification of death, or Dance of Death, from page 128 to 133 in Death, A Graveside Companion. It says, quote, a late medieval motif of the Dance of Death, which also depicts the moment of death, emphasizes the allegorical intent of the image. No matter who you are or what your level of privilege may be, death can arrive for you at any minute. The king, merchant, peasant, or baby that death ensnares is, in fact, every king, merchant, peasant, or baby. The language of the Dance of Death, despite depicting the moment of when death comes to claim another victim, is more akin to that of the editorial cartoon or comic strip than the documentary photograph. These images are meant to inspire contemplation and fear, not empathy. So basically what they're saying is this isn't a anatomical picture. It's not a photograph showing a corpse or a loved one who has died, who is also a corpse, just saying. This is a cartoon. This is a satire. This is gallows humor at its finest. Now, gallows humor gets thrown around a lot in not always the most appropriate things. Basically, in order for gallows humor to apply, you have to also be, quote-unquote, in the gallows. It's not for the executioner to laugh at, it's for the person getting hung. Anyway, basically, we all go and die. Whether that's... Anyway, hopefully not anytime soon. But because we are all going to die, we can all make fun of death. Put a silly hat on his skeleton head and call him silly names. That's basically what it's saying. So the Dance of Death first appeared on the wall of a charnel house. I don't speak French. I took it in college after taking 4 years of German in high school, and every time my French instructor would ask me a question, I would answer her in German because that's how my brain works. So my French pronunciation is terrible. Anyway, a charnel house is a vault for storing bones unearthed when digging new graves. In a future episode, I'll talk about how cultures outside of the US deal with their dead and burying them. Basically, graves are temporary. You rent it for a certain amount of time, and then your bones get sent off to your family or ancestors, and I don't know what happens to it at that point. And a new person gets buried in your hole. That came out wrong. We're gonna stick with it. So Dance of Death appeared on this wall of this bone house in the cemetery, or the Holy Innocent Cemetery in Paris. It was a mural created around 1424 and survived, at least according to Death, a Graveside Companion, until 1669, when the building was demolished in order to make way for a widened road. Because progress over mourning, I guess. So the Dance of Death shows literally, like, here is a king and a skeleton. They're holding hands, they're dancing. The skeleton's other hand is clasped with a little girl who is also holding hands with another skeleton, who is holding hands with a priest, who is holding hands with your neighbor. Like, it's that, and they're all dancing together in a chain, laughing about the fact that we all gonna die. So let's see. There's also many, many different versions of Danse Macabre. One of the other versions was Le Grand Danse Macabre de Homs by Lyon in 1499. Again, I don't speak French. Showing death in its familiar skeletal form, disrupting a bookshop, interrupting the work of a compositor, placing type and halting the printing of the book. It was also the first time that a printing press was shown in, like, a printed book, you know, in an image of a book. So basically, we're like, hey, look at this cool thing that we invented so that people don't have to hand draw out every line in a book anymore. Like, we have this cool little printing press thing, so we're gonna put it in a book, but who should we have in it? Like, definitely the guy that puts the type in, but who should he be interacting with? Should he be showing it off? Nah, we're gonna have Death fucking up his day. He's gonna come in, fuck everything up, interrupt him, and laugh about how everything dies or something. Because morbid humor, right? Hilarious. The most widely known and reproduced version of a Danse Macabre would be Hans Holbein's Dance of Death from 1538. It's basically a book I say basically, but it is a book where every page features a different woodcut art print showing a person and death. So one of the pictures that I saved from the Kindle book preview, it's put out by Penguin Classics, but from the Kindle book preview, it is a art print titled The King. And so it shows a king sitting down at a table. There are dishes all around him. They're all like half empty. There's a little hourglass on the table because that's another thing that early death gods, and specifically this version of death with a capital D, was seen with the scythe and an hourglass, meaning your time is almost up. So he's sitting at the table, this king, plates all around him, an hourglass is there, there's a crowd all around his throne, and on the other side of the table, holding the king's gaze, is a skeleton. And the skeleton is pouring the king what looks like a glass of wine. Like, here you go, take a sip of this. I'm sure it won't be poison. Oops, psych. Hilarious. So that, again, The Dance of Death from Hans Holbein is one of the most famous collections of Danse Macabre. Totentanz, basically the same sort of thing, though that was a little more, it was from a different author whose name I did not include in these notes because there was already too much, and that's fine. His was criticized for being a little more political based, and people didn't really like that as much. Death and the Maiden is a German trend, a German meme, if you will, from around this time, being 1660s, 1500s, somewhere in there, where you show death in skeleton form dancing or hanging all over a nice, beautiful young woman. And it has a comment on society, like, oh, even beauty dies, sort of thing. So that's where we start seeing death as a skeleton. That makes sense. Now, like I said, in this art print book from Hans Holbein, it's death with a bunch of different people. And sometimes death is dressed up in jester clothing. Sometimes he's just a naked skeleton. Sometimes he's wearing, like a regular peasant's outfit. He's not really picky, but he also hasn't settled on that scythe in one hand, robe, can't really see his face, just a bony finger getup that we all kind of associate him with now. So I get where a lot of articles and things are pointing to with the Grim Reaper came from here, but I also don't quite agree. Like, because this is shortly after plague time, in the midst of plague time, like I said, 1530s. Last time that the plague really hit Europe was 1666. That's not quite the Grim Reaper. It's death with a capital D. But it's not quite the Grim Reaper. So, where the hell does the Grim Reaper come from? Well, let's talk about those plague carts again, shall we? One of the other names that kept coming up when I was looking up where the hell did the freaking Grim Reaper come from was this quote unquote Celtic. I don't know why I said quote unquote, it's a Celtic death god, psychopomp, death deity, however you want to classify it, called, and I believe this is how you pronounce it, Ankou. And Ankou, according to this website called Mystic Mask, mask is spelled Masque, says, in the folklore of Brittany, located in northwestern France, which, again, don't quite remember my history, but apparently this part was Celtic in France. Anyway, the Ankou is awfully often described as a tall man or sometimes a shadow clothed in black robes, often wearing a wide-brimmed hat which covers his face with flowing white hair. He can be hooded or appear as a haggard, old, or gaunt, ghostly man, but can also be symbolized as a skeleton, sometimes headless, or with a head or skull that can rotate on its spinal axis, seeing everything anywhere around him. Spooky. He is sometimes attributed to as having abyss-like sockets for eyes, sometimes fiery, glowing eyes. In another legend, he is said to be blind after meeting with Saint Peter, who removed the fire from his eyes because rude. The because rude was my quote, not Mystic Masks. He is known to ride atop a black cart, funeral buyer slash hearse, coach, or even a chariot pulled by two or more, sometimes even four, black horses, oxen, and in coastal regions, he is sometimes described as traveling in a boat. So he's adaptable. The Ankou, like Death, is often shown wielding a scythe, but is also depicted holding a lance, spear, or arrow, or even a sword. Whatever the form of his weapon, it would be used to strike down each of his victims. It is also said that his deathly tool is sharpened by the bone of one of his deceased victims. Again, rude. So there's that. From another book, and this one from the 1800s, this is Omens and Superstitions, Curious Facts and Illustrative Sketches from 1868, by William P. Nemo, from pages 136 to 137, chapter called Brittany Nightwalkers. The author says, "In Brittany, there is scarcely a rock, a fountain, a wood, meaning woods or forest, or a cave to which some tale of wonder or dread is not attached. Every operation of nature the Bretons ascribe to miraculous interposition, and they people the air, they populate the air, the earth, and the waters with supernatural agents of all sorts." Miss Plumptre, in her pleasant book, and I could not find any other mention of her name, mentions several of these spirits who, quote, fly by night. So this author further goes on. The Karagul Ankou, or Chariot of Death, is a terrible apparition covered with a white sheet and driven by skeletons, and the noise of the wheels is always heard in the street passing the door of a house where any person is dying. So again, this one was from 1868, and it was specifically an author going around this region and other regions near it, and speaking with people Grimm's Brothers tale or style, and writing down their folklore, the stories that they passed down. So this woman, Miss Plumptre, either verbally or in a book form, because I could not, in the Google book scan of this book, it did not show me anything else from her, talked about the Ankou being a chariot of death, and the description sounds an awful lot like a plague cart, a cart carrying piles of bodies with squeaky wheels and skeletons driving it, and how you can always hear it go by houses of people who have just died. I don't know, that just sounded spooky and cool. So that's a plague cart. And now, as far as the internet is concerned, the Ankou is a person, skeleton, who wears a big hat and robes and carries a scythe. So maybe that's where it came from, but maybe it's not quite where it came from. Maybe we decided later that one of the skeletons is the Ankou, even though the skeleton, or the Ankou at least, in the 1860s, according to this one author, was the chariot of death itself. I don't know. Research is strange. Things are lost to time. And as I've been joking with my best friend as I rant to her about the fact that I really thought a Grim Reaper episode would be an easy thing to just put out, you know, research a bit, put it out, get my foot started. A lot of this research is just ending up in a it is known, as she likes to joke. You know, it's just everybody knows the Grim Reaper is from the plague. The Grim Reaper is a skeleton who wears a robe and carries a scythe. And I'm like, but why? Where did that come from? And I don't know. I do not know. So, like I said, there's conflicting evidence. If I stick with my idea that for that time period, it looks like Anku was a chariot of death. Maybe it was specifically talking about one of the creatures on it. Maybe it really was the visual that we now associate with the Grim Reaper, as the internet says, but maybe not. Then where did the Grim Reaper get his robes from? So, I'm gonna run through a little list here, and I don't like lists. I feel like you can dive into so many things in lists and make them interesting, but we're gonna run through a little list here. In 1818, so about 50 years before this book about the Chariot of Death, or that mentioned the Chariot of Death, Mary Shelley invented science fiction by publishing the book Frankenstein. From 1836 to 1896, when he went to a public execution, because that was a thing that we did as a species, you could buy penny dreadfuls, which were serial fiction, very macabre, very spooky. And then on the American end of things, in the mid-1800s, so from like 1830s to 18 whatevers, you had authors like Irving Washington, who, if that name sort of sounds familiar, wrote about Ichabod Crane and the Headless Horseman in The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. And you also had poets and storytellers like Edgar Allan Poe, who was out there creating the mystery detective novel, though he is more known for things like The Raven. So you had some spooky people writing some spooky books in the 1800s. You also had the invention of, well, not the invention, but the fascination that the Victorian era people had with mourning and ghosts and spirit boards and spiritualism and seances and all of those fun things that we will definitely talk about in the future. And so I was thinking about this time period, and I'm like, huh, like something from the Victorian age that reminds me of the visuals of the Grim Reaper. And then I remembered this little book by Charles Dickens called A Christmas Carol from 1843. And I'm remembering specifically the ghost of Christmas yet to come. He is a silent figure dressed all in black robes. You can only see a spectral hand. That is a direct quote from it. He's described as ominous and foreboding, and he brings Scrooge to his own funeral and shows people who he knew going through his house, stealing his shit, and selling it for a profit. And then he goes to Tiny Tim's house, Bob Cratchit's house, to see how badly the family is doing after the death of Tiny Tim, and that's when he's finally like, dude, take me back in time, give me another chance. So it's never said, and I really need to completely read that Christmas Carol book, but anyway, in every version that I've seen, the ghost of Christmas yet to come is never called death, but damned if that doesn't sound exactly like our Grim Reaper, right? I mean, This one didn't carry a scythe, but that's about it. So, after all of this, the 1800s and stuff, humanity had a, and specifically, again, because Grim Reaper specifically, we kind of had some tragedies going on. We had World War I, cholera outbreaks, tuberculosis, the Spanish flu in 1920, World War II. In the silent film era in the 20s, we started to see stories like The Phantom of the Opera brought to screen, and Nosferatu, which is, vampire movie in silent films. And then Disney got involved, like they do with many legends, and I'm kind of wanting to say Disney did it. Disney, in partnership with Charles Dickens, but Disney made this spooky short, or a couple spooky shorts, in 1929. One in August called The Skeleton Dance. You might know it from that video you see every Halloween, spooky, scary skeletons, the little dancing skeletons, happy jingle. Later on that year, in December, Mickey Mouse met up with those same skeletons and an animated Grim Reaper in a short called The Haunted House. And again, just like the spectral Mr. Scrooge, Ebenezer Scrooge visiting ghost of Christmas yet to come, that is exactly what that guy looked like. Around this same time, you start seeing, like, propaganda and newsprints. Like this one that I'm looking at right now from 1912 in December. It looks like it's a French one. You see it pop up in articles talking about, like, yeah, the Grim Reaper's from the plague era, and this is a 1912 Le Petit Journal talking about le cholera, where there is a crowd of people on a shoreline and death is flying over them, cutting them down with a gigantic scythe. That's not plague era, just saying. And then again, around 1925, you see there is this book called Ein Totentanz, again with the Dance of Death, von Alfred Kuben, by Alfred Kuben. From the title page, there is a picture of the Grim Reaper skeleton, hood, robes, scythe. Actually, in this one, it looks like he's holding a sickle, the little C-shaped knifey thing. And over his shoulder is a tree limb, like a palm leaf. The image is called Die Blätter mit dem Tod. Which, and again, my German is kind of rusty. It's been a while since I took it, but looks like it says death with with leaves. And that's literally what it is. He is sitting on planet Earth with a starscape and the planets behind him. And again, that's from 1925. So clearly, by the early 1900s, we had decided that that's what Grim Reaper looks like. Again, I'm going to stop this recording and start again so that I have time. So again, early 1900s, that's when we definitely were decided on that fully. There is a painting or an etching that I found by Gustave Doré from 1865, and it is Death on a on the Pale Horse. Shows literally a pale horse with skeleton robes and a scythe, and then all kinds of monstrous creatures flying, demons flying behind it through the clouds. And that is specifically describing one of the fourth horsemen of the apocalypse from the Book of Revelations. And it's Revelation 6:8 or something. I don't know religion. Anyway, It says, "And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and his name that sat on him was Death, and hell followed with him, and power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth to kill with sword, and with hunger, and with death, and with the beasts of the earth." So, little six of one, half dozen of the other, we've got this amalgamation of Danse Macabre, Toten Danse, Toten Tanz, not mashing up death and dance in French, death in German, death and dance in French. I'm clearly getting a little tired. So we've got a mashup of Danse Macabre, Toten Tanz, Death and the Maiden, a little bit of Book of Revelations, a little bit of the Gothic literature resurgence in the mid-1800s, little bit of world wars and this creation of these new media platforms being silent film and animation. All of that came together to create the Grim Reaper. So that's basically where a week of research has brought me, is kind of Disney did it, but also everybody did it. So brings me to my conclusion of my first episode. I want to leave you guys with two things. One being a question: where do you think Death with a capital D will go next? Do you think, especially with the pandemic, that we're going to see another shift in how we see it? Maybe not immediately, maybe in the next 50 to 100 years? Is something like Slenderman or other creepypasta characters going to have influence over that? Are we going to start seeing death less as skeleton in a robe with a scythe and more unnaturally tall, long-limbed person-ish with no face and a suit and long tentacly arms? I don't know. That's my question. Where do you think it'll go? Also, want to do this thing where I shout out some of my favorite death nerdy things in pop culture. So, first pop culture death related icon of the day has to go to Death with a capital D, aka the Fourth Horseman of the Apocalypse, specifically from the TV series Supernatural, because the show ended a few months ago. I am still heartbroken to a embarrassing extent over the whole thing, but damn if they didn't make that intro for Death's character in episode 21 of the fifth season, titled 2 Minutes to Midnight, written by Sarah Gamble, directed by Phil Scritchia, don't know if I pronounced that right, and performed by Julian Richings. They made that intro so fucking good. There's a haunting cover of the American folk song Oh Death, performed by Jen Titus, that plays over the whole thing. The end of the little clip there is, "My name is Death, and the end is here." And if you've never seen it before, one, go look it up on YouTube. There's like a little clip of it that somebody has put up years ago, and it's perfect. It's like a couple minutes long. Go do yourself a favor and watch it. For those of you who don't have time or just want a little refresh, it's this white Cadillac. I believe it's a white Cadillac. Pulling up to the curb in Chicago, because everything in Supernatural goes down in Chicago except the finale, which was trash. Anyway, moving on. White Cadillac pulls up, and it's this old, beautiful, long-finned one. Out walks Julian Richards, dressed in a black suit, carrying a cane. And he walks down the street, which is crowded. And you see this guy who looks like some kind of salesman or lawyer, as Supernatural is wont to do, dressed in a suit, talking on a cell phone, and he walks into Death, bumps shoulders with him, doesn't really say anything, and keeps walking. And Death looks over his shoulder at him and brushes some invisible dirt off his shoulder, very Jay-Z style. And a beat later, cell phone man clutches his chest and falls dead to the sidewalk, and death keeps walking. And the whole time, this haunting, beautiful cover of Oh Death is playing, and it's epic. So if you've never done yourself the favor of watching it, do it. I know Supernatural is often seen as an embarrassing part of internet culture, an embarrassing phenomena on Tumblr, but especially that first chunk of seasons 1 through 5 has a very particular American pulpy, just great visual nature to them, and it's a very well done scene. So do yourself a favor and watch it. Again, my name is Amy. You are listening to Grim Fixation, and thank you. Thank you for giving me your time. Have a great day.